From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I'm here today asking the court to do the right thing. And the right thing means to honor the Constitution in regards to our pension and in all things. The right thing means to honor the men and women who dedicated their efforts towards the great state of Illinois.
Invoking the police powers is not something that the state can do willy-nilly. It can only occur in the context of the need to address an important public purpose. And the courts do agree that there's a serious fiscal crisis can be such an important public purpose.
And the reason these police powers should be invoked is because the dire situation that the state is in, right?
Yes.
Any incongruity between that and the income tax reduction by 25%?
The contract clause is written in absolute language. Both the federal and the Illinois contract clause say, with no exceptions, that impairment of contract, that no law shall be passed impairing the obligations of contract. But both this court and the United States Supreme Court, for more than a century and a half, have said that we don't read that clause as absolute.
The Pension Protection Clause has plain, clear, unambiguous language with, again, no stated exception. We note that that language is so simple and plain that the voter's guide concerning the 1970 Constitution, the guide for the voters to aid them in understanding what they were voting for, simply said, this section is new and self-explanatory.
And those voices and discussions all surrounding a case before the Illinois Supreme Court this week that they heard on an expedited basis, the court did, and that is over whether the pension reform law that was passed a little more than a year ago is constitutional or whether it's unconstitutional as declared by a lower court judge. And we'll be talking about it on State Week, among other issues. Joining us on State Week today is Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio. I'm Bill Wheelhouse, and our guest this week, Kurt Erickson of Lee Enterprises Springfield Bureau, includes newspapers in Decatur, Bloomington, Carbondale, and the Quad Cities, among others. Kurt, thanks for dropping by today.
Glad to be here.
And I'm glad to have you. Well, the first thing we have with this Supreme Court hearing was the decision or the discussion of whether the state would have the power to do away with that constitutional provision guaranteeing pension, lack of diminishment of pension because of the dire fiscal condition of the state. Amanda Vinicky, you were there. Set it up for us.
Well, so there's, of course, so much anticipation about this case because of what's riding on it. Either if you are a state employee or a retiree, a downstate teacher or a university employee, such as myself, Bill, and Charlie, and what it means as an impact on your retirement. What money will you have going forward? And then for the state, of course, the $111 billion unfunded pension liability and the cost overall of these retirement benefits after for so many years, lawmakers didn't put the employer's share into retirement benefits. And the cost that that literally has for the state going forward, because paying basically a quarter of every dollar that comes into state into pensions means that that's a quarter of every dollar you can't put towards these immediate or other needs, be it education. So we go into it with that framework. The Solicitor General, who we heard from there, Carolyn Shapiro, said that there is an emergency situation and there basically, all right, so here, let me frame it like this. There is this pension clause in the state constitution that says benefits shall not be diminished nor impaired. It also refers to them as a contractually enforceable benefit. So Carolyn Shapiro really based her argument on that first part, saying it's a contract. Contracts can be modified. And then you had the plaintiffs, so people, lawyers that were representing, in specifically the lawyers that spoke, represented retired teachers and university annuitants. They focused more on this diminished and impaired. They said that simple language, can't get around it. There's no way for the state to do this.
So the judges, the justices, a lot of people, when they're watching a Supreme Court case, try to gauge how an opinion might come out eventually based on the line of questioning. Were there a lot of questions, and what were the angles of those questions?
There were some notable questions. For the most part, it was quiet, and the justices, a few took notes. But, you know, I mean, it's a pretty quiet affair. There was a packed courtroom. I counted about 50 people there, just two legislators, including State Senator Kwame Raoul, a Democrat who'd been one of the sponsors of the measure. He was there, and when you did hear from the justices, it was often a couple of questions from Chief Justice Rita Garman, one question from Justice Carmeier, and he had asked about, you know, the people voted this, the people voted for the Constitution. So who's to say if we're worried about the weight of the people and if that is the strongest part of our democracy? Hey, this is the Constitution that they voted for. But really, the strongest line of questioning came from Justice Robert Thomas. And you really had to almost come away with the feeling that he is going to swat down this law. He asked questions, as we heard in the opening there, notably, hey, the tax increase rolled back at the start of the year. How can this state make an argument that there is a fiscal emergency when that was allowed to happen? Clearly, there isn't any emergency if you're allowed to have that roll back. And then he also said, this is a situation of the state's own making. It was all of those years. Or he asked questions about that. You heard Carolyn Shapiro say, it's not just that legislators and governors went so long without putting the employer share in. She tried to say that it was also the length and the depth of the Great Recession that was unexpected that caused this huge unfunded liability in the pensions. But again, Thomas did not seem to buy that. The justice said, this is a situation of the state's own making, and questioned, basically, if we allow this, if the court were to allow this pension overhaul law to stand, what would that mean? That the state can get out of contracts whenever it wants to?
It's like the Lizzie Borden defense. I believe that's one of the attorneys who used that, where you know, the Lizzie kills her parents and then asks the state for mercy because she's an orphan, so.
Charlie Wheeler, your thoughts and perspective on this?
I thought it was interesting that all the questioning done at the oral arguments was by the three Republican justices. And Amanda, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe any of the Democratic justices mm-mm. asked a single question.
Just those three.
Now,
I don't know what to read into that. But the fact of the matter is that for all of the arguments that the state has made that this is such a fiscal emergency, in reality, they're not asking the court to uphold the law. What the defendants are asking is simply to have the Supreme Court send the case back to the circuit court so that they can make the argument that this fiscal emergency exists. On the other hand, the plaintiffs who are challenging the law say it's flat out unconstitutional because it's pretty clear what the constitutional language reads. And if you get behind it to the colloquy that occurred during the debates at the convention, some of the back and forth between delegates and lawmakers, in essence, the question was raised with the delegate who sponsored this particular provision in the Constitution. Isn't it true that if this were enacted, the legislature in the future would not be able to change benefits? And the answer was, yeah, and that's why we're doing it. So, I mean, it's pretty clear.
I do think that you point out an important distinction. And first of all, actually, in terms of the looking back to the 1970 Constitution, something that, you know, the state tried to make, and you heard from Solicitor General Shapiro, was that this was a question of timing. She tried to argue that the reason you have this one-sentence pension clause is because of a situation that was going on elsewhere at the time, and because it was, you know, Illinois was beginning this issue of home rule. And so that was why they, and that had come midway through the Constitution being drafted, the contractual part had already been written and done with, and then they went back and added this in and basically just took the clause from the state of New York. And so she tried to say we shouldn't pay too much attention to the weight given to the pension clause as a standalone. And therefore, she said, it should just be considered just like any other contract, which you don't typically get to modify, but you do in these extreme circumstances.
Well, with all due respect to the to Ms. Shapiro, I guess if I were in her position, I'd be grasping at things like that also.
A question, though. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in the meantime, the Supreme Court's across the street, on the other side of the street in the Capitol, there's a sense of paralysis because this has such this will have such a big effect on the state budget, which is already a mess. And so everybody's kind of sitting here huddling in their corners, teeth chattering, sweating.
Wondering what'll happen. Well, and this is what I wanted to say. I wanted to point out, as you noted, the state is basically just asking that the law, the premise of the law, the ability to modify pensions be upheld and then remand it to a lower court. And so when Justice Thomas asked these questions of the state, Shapiro said, that's a question for the merits. That's not the case that we're arguing here. That's something to be decided by a lower court. Just uphold the law on its face. That was the argument that she was trying to make. So just kind of an important distinction there as we go forward.
So I'll ask the question because I'm not quite following there. Was the question before the court to decide on the constitutionality, or was whether they can send it back and have somebody hear the argument then?
Well, I mean, the court can do whatever it wants.
I mean, the court
but
can
what,
rule
what the
on
plaintiffs,
the
what the plaintiffs were asking for was for the court to say flat out, the Constitution language means what it says in plain English. You can't diminish or impair the benefits. Therefore, Senate Bill 1, as this pension reform was characterized as it passed through the General Assembly, is unconstitutional on its face, period, end of the story. What the state is asking is entertain our notion that because we're in this extraordinary circumstance and the sky is falling down around us and the walls are collapsing, we have no choice but to violate the Constitution and send this case back to the circuit court so we can convince Judge Belts in Sangamon County that indeed it is the end of the world if we don't violate the Constitution. Now, that's obviously hyperbole, but in my mind, that's the basic, what would you say, the basic questions being put before the justices.
So here, what the state is putting that notion in the mind of the justices on this case, I mean, essentially.
Well, my understanding of the way the whole judicial process works is that justices are supposed to approach all of these issues with, what would you say, no preconceived notions, and they're supposed to weigh them on the merits of the arguments that are presented. Or in the case of an important decision like this, on the briefs that have been offered, citing legal precedent, citing what's happened in other jurisdictions, and then use their best judgment.
I'd be interested in people hearing a response to another theory. You folks all mentioned that the Democratic justices, who are the majority, did not mention anything. Those are the ones that House Speaker Michael Madigan did help get elected through fundraising efforts and things of that nature. There is always the theory out there, Madigan was instrumental in getting this bill passed, that somehow that court might just go along with him. Did it say anything to you that the Democrats, who are the majority, didn't ask any questions? They were minority justices asking the questions.
I hesitate to read anything into that because who, again, there were plenty of briefs. It's not as if these justices are, you know, coming into this cold. They're well aware of the situation. They've read these hundreds and hundreds of pages, presumably of documents that were filed. So it's really hard to tell what a court is ever going to do. Even Justice Thomas's questions, they were pretty direct, so you can kind of read something into there. But I caution against doing that ever. You do get to an interesting point there, Bill, in terms of just Madigan's connections in general. We have obviously Governor Bruce Rauner that has hammered a lot against Illinois' election of judges and influence there, he says, with trial lawyers. When the Senate Bill 1 was going through and did pass the Illinois House, after a Q&A with reporters, Speaker Madigan had said then that he was confident four of the justices would go along with him, and then was questioned right afterward, does that mean that you've talked to them? What makes you think that? And he was very careful and strident in saying, no, I have not talked with them at all. That is just my prediction. It's just my hope. He did, however, during the course of this, and it's therefore worthy of pointing out, I think, that the justices themselves, while they are state employees, their pensions won't be affected. Madigan, when he had, again, a sponsor of this law on the floor, said that he did that so that there wouldn't be any conflict of interest when they were to hear this case, because everybody had known that that was coming.
You're listening to State Week. Just ahead, we take a look at the budget shortfalls coming up in the current fiscal year.
Support for State Week in Review comes from Illinois Issues Magazine, deciphering Springfield legislation and the state of the state. Information at illinoisissues.uis.edu.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Venicky, Kurt Erickson of Lee Enterprises, and I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Well, while it is springtime, more or less, whether you go by meteorological spring, it is, unless you go by the calendar, it's not. But we're close to 3 months left of the fiscal year, and there is a short-term budget hole that needs to be filled if services are to continue as is. Kurt Erickson, you've reported on some of the areas where the budgets will come up short. One are the state's prisons. And several prisons could feel that pinch sooner than later.
Yeah, I went through some comptroller's payroll records and found five prisons that do not appear to have enough money to make it through the money for payroll to make it through the rest of the fiscal year through June 30th. And the shortfalls at the individual prisons are anywhere from like $700,000 to more than $1 million. And all told, the Department of Corrections says the shortfall for payroll is about $70 million, and overall it's about $117 million. So add that to the $300 million that a child care subsidy program is short, and you know, any number of programs that are, you know, the court reporters are falling short of their funding. So you've got this $1.6 billion hole in the current year budget, and that's become a major focus, you know, to get that resolved before you even start talking about next year's budget, which is going to be just as painful.
And people are coming to the state capitol and probably will be coming to the state capitol any day. Lawmakers are in session for the remainder of their session, speaking out against proposed cuts. We heard some of the state's universities had fiscal hearings this week, and higher education was trying to say, we can't take a 30% budget cut.
Yeah, 31.5%, which is worth about $400 million. Each of the, not all of the universities were here this week. There'll be some more coming, you know, next week or the week after to argue their case before lawmakers. But SIU, Southern Illinois University, and Eastern Illinois University, and Western Illinois University all said, we can't offset this kind of cut with an increase in tuition. That'll, you know, people will not be able to afford to go to our schools. We're already higher than many of our peer institutions as far as tuition goes. And, you know, if we have to take this kind of cut, we're going to have to lay off at Eastern, for example. It was 250 employees at in the SIU system. It was about 700 employees, including 450 at the Carbondale campus. And they're just saying that's not tenable. And they received a lot of support for that from both Democrats and Republicans in the appropriations hearings. So they were asked, well, if you can't take a 31% cut, what can you take? And SIU says, they want flat funding, but later kind of acknowledged that they could maybe withstand a 10% cut.
And I believe Eastern said 5 and Western said, no, we're cut to the bone already, everybody.
Yeah.
And
well, because it comes after years of the state looking at higher education as a place for cuts. So it's a continual, we've heard these debates continually at the state capitol, but never really to this extent. A 30% cut is a large one. The Rauner administration says it's really not 30%. Sure, maybe it's 30% of state funding, but look at all the other dollars that they get. It's not as if these universities' budgets will be completely cut by 30%. It's just a portion of their funding.
Right, and it won't cut the portion that comes from tuition. And, of course, universities are free to raise tuition if they'd like. I mean, this whole notion of the Rauner administration coming in and whacking everything and saying, well, we have to do it and you can find other ways to pay for it and there'll be no real suffering, I think it's pretty disingenuous. I hope it's part of a bargaining ploy to force the Democrats to take the lead on coming up with more revenue. I would hate to think that Governor Rauner actually believes that these kind of cuts are morally defensible to the vulnerable, the poor, the least advantaged in society. At the same time, tax breaks for the wealthy and for businesses that are profitable remain on the books. So, I mean, there's kind of a discongruity there. Maybe he doesn't appreciate what's going on.
Well, it brings to mind to me, it seemed like at some point in history, higher education used to be a fairly powerful lobby, especially the University of Illinois. Higher ed has taken cuts over the years, reductions, and it doesn't seem like the voters have spitted anybody for cutting colleges and universities. Is there something they need to ramp up to do differently? Or are they hanging out there in danger of more cuts, you think?
For most of the time I was an active reporter, higher education was looked at as being a very important investment for the state of Illinois, and their budgets grew from year to year. And schools admitted more students. The idea back then was to try and make college education affordable for everybody. And that kind of changed when Rod Blagojevich became governor. We used to joke that it was the revenge of the C student, because he whacked higher ed more than anything else. And it's continued since then. And as a result, you see tuitions increasing dramatically. You see fees charged by universities going up even more, because under current law, when my kid starts at the University of Illinois, whatever tuition he or she pays freshman year is frozen for the next 3 years, for the full 4 years that the person is there. But it doesn't say anything about fees. So fees keep getting jacked all the time. And so you have students leaving college with humongous amounts of student loan debt. And it strikes me that the priorities are wrong when you don't try to make college more affordable for average people, not for the folks who can send their kids to Ivy League schools, that kind of thing, but for the working families who do have to struggle so that their child can go to Eastern or Western or Southern.
And all the university presidents were all saying, if we have to raise tuition, more students are going to go to out-of-state schools, and that will create more of a brain drain. And if we have to lay off people, that hurts the local economy. So this is
it's all connected.
It's a backwards idea.
I think part of it is, though, that the anger hasn't gone toward the state for giving less money to universities. The frustration from the public goes to the schools. The blame is, hey, you're raising tuition, bad you school. So that's part of perhaps some of, you know, to Bill's original question and kind of the lobby in the other hand of this, legislators maybe not getting hurt as they've made cuts all over the place. There's not always the, oh, you cut funding for universities, perhaps, especially unless you're in a town where, you know, you're a professor working for that university and that's a lot of your voting base. Instead, voters' frustration is going toward the universities. And then there have also, of course, been headlines at schools like the University of Illinois will have a new president. But there was a while there where you had some presidents that had made headlines in not the right ways, and just administrators at universities making really big paychecks. They say that that's what's necessary to pay a competitive wage, and look across the country, and it's those are the wages that at a Big Ten school you're going to have a president or a chancellor making. Nonetheless, that I think has also caused some frustration from some lawmakers, and part of what Rauner points to.
Charlie's correct in that it does go back to the Blagojevich era, where it really, that's when the decreases really started to ramp up.
In a couple of minutes we have remaining too, we've heard that there were people negotiating among legislative leaders and the governor for finding the money for filling the shortfall for the remainder of the fiscal year. Then we hear that, no, they weren't real negotiations. What's going on there?
There is talk that something could pop up next week. The House would kind of start it, and it would be a series of maybe, allowing Rauner to have some kind of ability to sweep funds and across the board cuts at agencies of some level. We've heard 2.2%, And the idea is that Rauner needs to convince Republicans in the House to vote for this. So you'll see, you know, these things barely passing with all the Republican votes and 20 Democratic votes, or maybe they'll be failing and they'll have to go back to square one. So that's where I'm seeing it. There's going to be, you know, some talks over the weekend, maybe staff level, and then hopefully they'll kind of get going next week so people can move on.
And we'll see if we can get in some notes from the field. We'll start with Kurt Erickson of Lee Enterprises.
Well, this last week, Governor Rauner announced that he was freezing all grants to park districts, whether they were in the middle of a construction project or not. And that really sent communities scrambling because some of the places, like in Carbondale, they're building a what they call a splash park, a pool, and they were waiting for a $2.5 million grant to help pay for that, and they're 70 days from opening. So they don't know what's going on, and they're trying to figure that one out. There's pools in Mount Pulaski and Marion and all over the state, in Chicago, that they're very confused about, you know, kind of what do they do. It's almost summer, and we can't open.
And quickly, Amanda Venicky.
We're continuing to get a drip of headlines about ethical questions with Illinois Congressman Aaron Schock from Peoria. That includes a $10,000 trip he took staff on to New York City, questions about his personal wealth and connections with campaign contributors. In an interview this week, he said, "I certainly hope I didn't break the law."
That's all the time we have for this week's State Week. Thanks to Kurt Erickson of Lee Enterprises for joining us. You can go get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching for State Week in Review. On your phone, search it out at iTunes U. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.